Arsenal for Democracy is freely available weekly at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple and Stitcher, and we're supported by some listeners at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy for $3 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stuntbird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 417, recorded on March 20th, 2022. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line, as always, from Boise, Idaho, is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
So this week, we're going to be talking about another industry from various parts of the world, but predominantly the United States, and certainly it kind of gets its start there. We're going to be focusing overall on biotechnology, but we also need to talk about some related things around fermentation, penicillin, genetic engineering of crops, things like that. So since we have as the co-host of this show someone who is much more qualified than I am to talk about this, our friendly neighborhood microbiologist, Rachel, I thought we would start with her explaining some of the sort of historical origins of the biotechnology industry. Obviously, this is something that goes back in its rudimentary forms to ancient times. But how do we get from there to sort of the United States biotechnology sector that we would know and recognize today?
Yeah, so the earliest form of biotechnology is zymotechnology, which is the use of technology to improve beer brewing techniques. So beer is a very important commodity. It's a way for communities to safely drink liquids. Water oftentimes was very dangerous to drink. And so there was oftentimes most of your consumption of liquids came from beer or like weak wines. So these zymotechnology techniques were applied more broadly to improve agriculture and prevent famine and malnutrition. And although brewing today is a wide and varied field, filled with international mega corporations all the way down to nanobreweries, brewing held great economic power in the late 19th century. In Germany, for example, beer contributed as much to gross national product as steel, and taxes on alcohol were an important source of government revenue, so improvements in brewing were economically significant. An industry of consultants sprung up to advise brewers on how they could reap these technological benefits. And I'm going to be quoting from several sources throughout the episode. The Wikipedia History of Biotechnology, the Smithsonian, the FDA government website, among others. So quoting from the Wikipedia article on the history of biotechnology, the most famous of these consultants was the private Carlsberg Institute, founded in 1875, which employed Emil Christian Hansen, who pioneered the pure yeast process for the reliable production of consistent beer. Yeast is very important. If you have different yeast species, you're going to yield different tastes of your beer. So you really want to create a yeast strain that creates a consistent taste in your beer, and so you can market it as a certain type of beer that's always going to taste the same and taste good. Less well-known were private consultancies that advised the brewing industry. One of these, the Zymotechnik Institute, was established in Chicago by the German-born chemist John Ewald Siebel. So there were these various institutes and consultant firms that were kind of cropping up all throughout the world. So the heyday and expansion of zymotechnology came in World War I in response to industrial needs to support the war. Max Delbruck grew yeast on an immense scale during the war to meet 60% of Germany's animal feed needs. Compounds of another fermentation product, lactic acid, made up for a lack of hydraulic fluid in the form of glycerol. On the Allied side, the Russian chemist Chaim Weizmann used starch to eliminate Britain's shortage of acetone, a key raw material for cordite, by fermenting maize to acetone. the industrial potential of fermentation was outgrowing its traditional home in brewing, and zymotechnology soon gave way to biotechnology. Fermentation-based processes generated products of ever-growing utility. In the 1940s, penicillin was the most dramatic. While it was discovered in England, it was produced industrially in the U.S. using a deep fermentation process originally developed in Peoria, Illinois. The enormous profits and the public expectations penicillin engendered caused a radical shift in the standing of the pharmaceutical industry. Doctors used the phrase, quote, miracle drug, and the historian of its wartime use, David Adams, has suggested that to the public, penicillin represented the perfect health that went together with the car and the dream house of wartime American advertising. And we have talked about advertising on several episodes in the past and how it was kind of coming up into its own in the 1940s and 1950s, and how advertising kind of shaped the views of the public, and penicillin kind of was a part of that as well. Beginning in the 1950s, fermentation technology also became advanced enough to produce steroids on industrially significant scales. Of particular importance was the improved semi-synthesis of cortisone, which simplified the old 31-step synthesis to 11 steps. This advance was estimated to reduce the cost of the drug by 70%, making the medicine inexpensive and available. So at this time, I think in our minds, we think of antibiotics and other pharmaceutical interventions as being kind of old, but penicillin is a relatively recent discovery, and the industrial application and production of it is definitely very recent. And penicillin really did change the scene of the pharmaceutical industry. A lot of procedures just became a lot safer, and because there was always a risk for like surgical interventions of sepsis setting in, and a lot of mortality was prevented by the use of penicillin in these applications. So let's fast forward to the 1950s. Modern biotechnology was born in 1953 when Watson and Crick described the structure of DNA. And I just want to point out, this is based on research by Rosalind Franklin, who didn't really get her due until relatively recently. Another major breakthrough was the 1973 discovery by Cohen and Boyer of a recombinant DNA technique by which a section of DNA was cut from the plasmid, and a plasmid is a small molecule of DNA separate from chromosomal DNA. So a small section of DNA was cut from the plasmid of an E. coli bacterium and transferred into the DNA of another. This approach could, in principle, enable bacteria to adopt the genes and produce proteins of other organisms, including humans. And as we'll get into more detail later, this recombinant DNA technique was used to synthesize human insulin in bacteria in the first pharmaceutical application of this technology. And in 1978, the University of California patented the gene that produces human growth hormone, thus introducing the legal principle that genes can be patented. However, a 2013 Supreme Court case, Association for Molecular Pathology v. Myriad Genetics, Inc., ruled that human genes cannot be patented in the U.S. because DNA, quote, is a product of nature. The court decided that because nothing new is created when discovering a gene, there's no intellectual property to protect, so patents cannot be granted. Prior to this ruling, more than 4,300 human genes were patented. The Supreme Court's decision invalidated those gene patents, making the genes accessible for research and for commercial genetic testing. The Supreme Court's ruling did allow that DNA manipulated in a lab is eligible to be patented because DNA sequences altered by humans are not found in nature. The court specifically mentioned the ability to patent a type of DNA known as complementary DNA, or cDNA. This synthetic DNA is produced from the molecule that serves as the instructions for making proteins, also known as messenger RNA, or mRNA, which has been in the news a lot lately. And I think we're all much more aware of mRNA or these kind of synthetic DNAs and RNAs over the last few years, obviously, in the production of a COVID-19 vaccine. Another big industry that genetic engineering has sprung up in is agriculture. So although agricultural food modification has been happening since the dawn of civilization, genetic engineering has allowed food science to accelerate. Prior to the genetic engineering era, modifying food plants and animals was a slow and arduous process of selective breeding and hoping that the results were beneficial to crop yields and hardiness. As most of us learned in high school biology, Gregor Mendel, a monk with a pea breeding hobby, discovered that traits from his peas were passed down from generation to generation, and was able to demonstrate the basics of genetics. In 1940, before the structure of DNA was even discovered, plant breeders used radiation or chemicals to randomly alter an organism's DNA, which sounds like an origin story for a comic book character, but it was in pretty widespread use at the time. After Cohen and Boyer's recombinant DNA breakthrough, a whole new world of agricultural food production opened up, but people were leery of genetically modified foods and how they might affect people who ate them. To regulate safety standards of genetically engineered foods, the federal government established the Coordinated Framework for the Regulation of Biotechnology in 1986. This policy describes how the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and U.S. Department of Agriculture work together to regulate the safety of GMOs. In 1994, the first GMO produce, a tomato, hit market shelves after it proved to be just as safe as traditionally bred tomatoes. In 2015, the FDA approved an application for the first genetically modified food animal, a GMO salmon. And in recent news, the FDA completed consultation on the first food from a genome-edited plant. So this came from the FDA.gov website about biotechnology, and it also goes through the process of developing a GMO plant. In their example, they chose BT corn from concept to market. So BT corn has a trait that is found in a bacterium called Bacillus thuringiensis, and it's a soil bacterium that creates a natural insecticide. So BT has been used as an insecticide for many years in organic agriculture, but then scientists isolated the gene that creates this insecticide, copied it, and then inserted the gene into the DNA of the corn plant. And this left the corn's other genes unaltered. So after that, scientists grow the new BT corn, first in laboratories, then in test fields, until they are sure the corn exhibits the desired insect resistance and that the corn is safe to consume. And this process takes years to review before it's made available to farmers and from there to market for consumers to buy and consume. So I found that process very interesting, very illuminating. There's a lot of research that goes into developing genetically modified food products. And so I feel like the website kind of helps allay those fears. I know there's a lot of problems with GMO food, especially on both the left and the right. And I think they mainly come from a source of like just scientific illiteracy, scientific ignorance of the process on how these foods are made and produced. And I know on the left, at least, there's a lot of concern on how these genes are used and how corporations control these genes and control these products and use those to manipulate farmers. They'll sell seeds that produce infertile crops, so you can't take the seeds from the crops that you planted and use them for subsequent generations. So I think from a scientific standpoint, it's a good thing. From a business standpoint, there's obviously some problems in the industry that need to be addressed. But as a whole, I would say the products are safe. I know there was a rice species called golden rice that created vitamin A for people who weren't getting enough vitamin A in their diet, which causes a disease called beriberi. And a lot of people had so many problems with this golden rice, this genetically modified rice, that is no longer available on the market. And so a food product that could have helped many people isn't available because there were so many concerns about genetically modified food. So it's a pretty touchy subject. And that's not really the focus of our episode today. We're just talking about the science mainly and how this technology developed. So going back to the story of synthetic insulin, recombinant DNA insulin, we found a Smithsonian Mag article, a website that describes an exhibition that kind of highlights the history of biotechnology and the first biotech startup as we think of it in the modern sense. So prior to 1982, diabetics got their insulin extracted from cow or pig pancreases, and the prices and supply varied based on the meat market, and it was really feared that the supply wouldn't be able to keep up with increasing numbers of diabetics. In the 80s, there were some projections that the number of people needing insulin would far outstrip the supply from these cow and pig pancreases. So it was kind of a scramble to come up with the first synthetic insulin. So Humulin, the first pharmaceutical application of recombinant DNA, appeared on the scene and changed the world in 1982. So one of the first achievements was synthetically building the human insulin gene in the lab, a single genetic base pair at a time. In order to check the accuracy of their sequence, they used a technique called gel electrophoresis, in which electricity forces the DNA through a gel. Because larger pieces of DNA migrate more slowly than smaller pieces, the process effectively filters the genetic material by size, allowing researchers to pick out the pieces they want, one of the key steps in early genetic sequencing methods. And the company that created this process, this recombinant DNA insulin, was called Genentech, and they were a startup based in San Francisco. So electrophoresis is still widely used, but the equipment donated by Genentech, which you can see and is displayed in the Smithsonian Institute, is decidedly more improvised than the standard setup seen in labs today. There's a quote from Mallory Warner, who worked on the display of these instruments. "You can see it's sort of made by hand. They use glass plates and binder clips because they were working really quickly all the time and they wanted something they could take apart and clean easily." And I would advise everybody to go look at these pictures, look at these instruments that are on display. They're very fascinating, especially when you compare them to their modern counterparts. Their electrophoresis machine is very rudimentary, very basic, and it looks quite different from what an electrophoresis chamber looks like today. So after synthesizing a gene for insulin, the scientists needed to assimilate it into a bacterium's DNA so that the organism would produce insulin on its own. They used a variety of enzymes to do so, including ECOR1, a chemical that cuts DNA in a precise location based on the surrounding base pairs. And this is what's known as a restriction endonuclease. And so it searches for these base pairs, a certain sequence of base pairs. And once it encounters that sequence of base pairs, it makes a cut in the DNA. And you create various fragments of varying sizes based on where these restriction enzymes cut the DNA. So researchers extracted small DNA molecules called plasmids from the bacterium, severed them with these enzymes, then used other enzymes to stitch the synthetic insulin gene in place. The new hybrid plasmid could then be inserted into live bacteria. Another subsequent innovation ushered in the age of biotechnology in earnest: polymerase chain reaction, or PCR, a chemical reaction developed in 1983 by biochemist Carrie Mullis that allows scientists to automatically multiply a DNA sample into greater quantities with significantly less manual work. The first prototype PCR machine, or thermal cycler, was based on researchers' knowledge of how enzymes like DNA polymerase, which synthesizes DNA from smaller building blocks, functioned at various temperatures. It relied on cycles of heating and cooling to rapidly generate large amounts of DNA from a small sample. And PCR is huge in the biotech world, the molecular biology world. Everything we do basically is based on PCR, including COVID-19's genetic sequencing. There is a step where the RNA of the COVID-19 is converted to complementary cDNA, or cDNA, as I mentioned earlier. And from there, it's amplified through a PCR process. And then from there, it's sequenced to assemble a whole COVID-19 genome. So it's very interesting how we're still using these technologies, just in a different way and with much more sophisticated instruments. The PCR, the thermocycler that was created in 1983, is definitely a very rudimentary, very basic looking instrument And it looks like it would be pretty hard to operate in comparison to today's thermocyclers. So it's kind of fascinating to see how much the technology has changed in just a few decades.
So one of the things that comes up a lot in discussions of things like insulin, which is obviously a popular political topic because of the high prices that are charged for it, for something that people need to stay alive, and something that also gets discussed frequently with relation to maybe not as much cancer research, but research into medicines and therapeutic treatments involving genetic engineering and things like that for relatively obscure diseases that, you know, only affect a very small number of people, but nevertheless do need to be solved in some way, is the role of private capital in this. And private capital was there at the beginning of this sort of version of biotechnology and the biotechnology industry, as we would recognize it today, as Rachel said. And it was there at the beginning with this synthetic insulin process and that startup Genentech. And in fact, private capital explicitly decided which biotech product Genentech would specifically attempt to produce after the scientists involved had developed a proof of concept showing that they had improvised the equipment and developed the knowledge needed to make something, right? So the question was what? And so quoting again from this Smithsonian Magazine piece on the new Smithsonian equipment exhibit, Genentech's work began with a discovery made in the 1970s by a pair of Bay Area scientists, Herbert Boyer of UC San Francisco and Stanley Cohen of Stanford. Genes from multicellular organisms, including humans, could be implanted into bacteria and still function normally. Soon afterward, they teamed with venture capitalist Robert Swanson to form the company with the hope of using genetic engineering to create a commercially viable product. Early on, they decided insulin was a logical choice. Quote, it was convenient, it was an easy protein to handle, and it was obviously something that a lot of people needed, end quote, says Diane Wendt, a Smithsonian curator who worked on the display. After the Genentech scientists successfully created bacteria with copies of the insulin gene, they confirmed that the microbes could produce human insulin in sufficient quantities in a fermentation tank. Then the genetically modified bacteria were passed off to researchers at Eli Lilly, who began producing it in commercial quantities for sale. Voila, synthetic human insulin. Now, drilling down on this a bit further, I wanted to quote from a 2020 blog post on LabBiotech, which is some website, which explains the role of private capital in the biotechnology industry and the importance of the fact that Genentech was started in the way that it was. However, to get the revolution going, the technology needed to reach the market. In January 1976, one of the scientists behind the study, Herbert Boyer, received a phone call. It was from a young venture capitalist called Robert Swanson, then a partner at the firm Kleiner & Perkins. Swanson was enthusiastic about the commercial potential of the recombinant bacteria and persuaded the reluctant Boyer to meet up for a few minutes. The meeting ended up lasting for hours, with Swanson convincing Boyer to found a company. The two made an initial agreement to invest $500 each, the equivalent of around $2,300 today, or at least in 2020, and Boyer also came up with a name for the company, Genentech, derived from the words genetic engineering technology. Genentech became the first biotech company to go public, raising $35 million on its IPO in 1980 dollars. After many years of getting drugs to the market, the company was eventually acquired by the Swiss giant Roche, or Roche probably, in 2009. Genentech's story is only one of many biotechs that sprang up in the early days of modern biotechnology. However, the company set many precedents for the biotechnology industry across the globe. With their tiny initial investments, the co-founders of Genentech set the trend for funding biotech ventures from venture capitalists. Biotechnology is a field in which both the costs and risks are high, making venture capital a common means for starting up a company. Genentech proved such an investment could be profitable when it was acquired. Nowadays, partnerships with or acquisitions by Big Pharma has become the goal of many small biotech companies, end quote. So basically similar to a lot of other industries these days, but you can kind of see that the emergence of the genetic engineering and broader biotechnology sector at the time, based on available technology and recent discoveries, that coincides with the sort of rise of venture capital type private capital formations and their specific approach to and style of investment. And I think it is worth sort of pausing here, and I don't know, Rachel, if you wanted to comment on this, to just kind of acknowledge that this is like not a good way of doing medical research. It's not socially responsible, certainly, but it really kind of warps where the focus is.
Right. I'm sure we've all heard of Theranos and how the venture capital kind of funded this scientifically dubious company. And it seems like venture capital is always chasing what the big new exciting discovery is. And there is a real cost to that. For example, antibiotics are kind of languishing. I found a Nature article and from the abstract, just quoting from it, antibiotic resistance is undoubtedly one of the greatest challenges to global health, and the emergence of resistance has outpaced the development of new antibiotics. However, investments by the pharmaceutical industry and biotechnology companies for research into and development of new antibiotics are diminishing. The public health implications of a drying antibiotic pipeline are recognized by policymakers, regulators, and many companies. So because developing new antibiotics or other antimicrobials is a long and arduous process and filled with failures or drugs that just don't make it to market for one reason or another at various points in the process, it's just not very exciting, and therefore the money for research and development just isn't there. And we're all at the victims of this kind of growing threat of antibiotic resistance. It's a very scary prospect and one that the scientific community is trying to raise the alarm about, but it's hard to get that investment if we're stuck in kind of this funding model that is trying to seek out these kind of exciting companies that get offered at really high IPOs and whatnot. So it's really scary that this is the way that biotechnology is funded, and it's definitely a danger to the industry.
Well, and the problem is something that we've known about for a while and are continuing to not do anything about, right? I mean, this is, you know, in line with, we know that there's going to be, and have now found out in the past few years the hard way about this, we know there's going to be pandemics. We know that many of the things that cause pandemics, like factory farming practices or irresponsible biological research laboratories, these are things that can be dealt with, but it requires money and political will, and these would reduce our risk. Similarly, global warming. We know the carbon emissions problem. We've been warning about it for decades, still not doing much about it. And, you know, corporations and countries keep on launching stuff into orbit in space and then letting it crash into each other or deliberately shooting missiles at it and breaking it apart. So now we have a space junk problem with thousands and thousands of objects orbiting around space, crashing into each other, causing all sorts of damage and potentially, you know, eventually getting a Kessler effect cascade that can, you know, just sort of take out all of our communication satellites. This is the same type of thing. We've known about the antibiotic resistant tuberculosis and stuff like that, and just antibiotic resistance in general. We've known about this for quite a while. It's getting worse. The problem is already here, so it's not even a question of the future, but we're continuing to really not do anything about it, no matter how many sort of panicked things get put out there in the press.
Yeah, I think it's really a shame that we've made our research and development so dependent on private investment, or even if it's publicly invested in, we go and turn it over to a company that develops it privately, as is the case for our vaccines or a lot of our drugs were developed at university labs and then kind of get licensed to these private companies. So it's a very broken system, and it really just comes down to a lack of public investment, or keeping our public investments public. When we turn around and privatize them, we're really limiting what we can do with those private products and further innovation and development that can come about because of those innovations. So it's really a shame that we've privatized our system so much to the detriment of our public health, in all these different facets.
Yeah, I just wanted to acknowledge one other thing that was sort of not within the scope of the industrial focus that we were talking about today, but I think does need to be mentioned before we wrap up an episode on U.S. biotechnology, which is HeLa cells. So I don't know if you wanted to say anything on that, but, you know, there's been a book on that, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, which was then turned into an HBO miniseries and so forth. But I like that this industry, despite how relatively modern it is also not immune from some of the troubling racial exploitation legacies of the rest of the sort of medical and biological sectors before the advent of this industry.
Yeah, I'm not super familiar with the story. I haven't read the book, but I've encountered it a few different times. So Henrietta Lacks was a cancer patient who was Black, and her cell line was basically taken and used for research on various things. So I think it was a very robust cell line. It survived well. It propagated well. And so her cells are basically being used as a research component, and she and her family never got any remuneration, any recompense for like the entire industry using her cells. So it definitely points out the continuing exploitation of Black people in the medical industry and how they've been, they haven't been compensated for their contributions to science, whether voluntary or for the most part, in many cases, involuntary participation in these research projects.
Yeah. And to, you know, close the loop on this, like the cells have been crucially important for saving literally millions, if not billions of lives because of how some of the technologies and things that have been used. For example, the polio vaccine was developed using HeLa cells. Not even that long, within just a couple of years, actually, of Henrietta Lacks' cells being taken and donated, not only without her consent, but shortly before her death from cancer at a very young age. I think she was about 31 when she died. And by 1953, there was a cell culture factory at Tuskegee University, if that should also be ringing an alarm bell in terms of bioexploitation. But that was the factory that was used to reproduce these HeLa cells in order for Jonas Salk to do his research into the polio vaccine. And this was ready for human trials, according to the Wikipedia page on HeLa, by less than a year later. And so this is like that. The reason I'm bringing this up just kind of at the end, even though it's a little bit off topic, but not completely, is just that in some ways we think of this industry, this biotechnology industry, as being a very, you know, technologized industry using very complicated equipment and things like that, right? And obviously, like, DNA is a complicated thing, but there's also been, you know, when you're talking about a factory involved in one of these industries, in some cases it's to mass produce these type of cells that are human cells or some other biological cell that we're going to need to do our research or modifications or whatever. And we should acknowledge some of the legacies of where some of that stuff comes from.
Absolutely. I was unaware that the polio vaccine was developed using HeLa cells. That's fascinating. And I would definitely recommend that people read the book and learn more about her life. I'm certainly going to. I've had it recommended to me several times. I just haven't gotten around to reading it, but
Yeah, I think I'm only even aware of it because obviously I'm not from a science background. I'm only aware of it because it was an assigned reading thing during a summer research program at the University of Delaware, where I went to college, because they wanted to teach us about why institutional review boards came into existence and why there's ethical concerns and considerations around human subject or even human remains related research, whether it's hard sciences like this or anthropological things or, you know, controversies around human leather bound books. There's all sorts of considerations, and this was something that they had assigned, I believe, in this program. I don't even remember the details at this point because it's been over a decade now, I think. That was just something that I felt it was important for us to mention in the context of this biotechnology industry, that there were real human beings involved with this in ways that you might not even think about.
Right. And venture capital is kind of all about disruption, but oftentimes the things they're disrupting are things like ethics and industry standards that are meant to prevent these types of exploitative conditions.
All right. Well, Rachel, thanks so much for coming on this week to talk about the emergence of the biotechnology industry in the United States.
Thanks. It was a great topic.